Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, today we will take Sutta number 6 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Akankheya Sutta. The word Akankheya means if one should wish. This is on page 115. Okay, the sutta begins as it does so often when the Buddha was living in Jetavana Monastery in Savatthi. And he opens the discourse with an exhortation to the monks. This is a stock passage. He says, "Bhikkhus, dwell possessed of virtue, sila sampanna, possessed of the patimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest faults, train by undertaking the training precepts." Okay, with this statement, the Buddha emphasizes that the training in sila, this is moral discipline or moral virtue, is the foundation for the training in the Buddha's path. And all of the higher stages of the training are based upon this foundation of sila, moral discipline or virtue. So the word virtue, the word sila has different connotations or suggests different levels of meaning. One level of meaning is certainly virtue in the sense of moral discipline. And in relation to, we call the 5 precepts, which are undertaken by lay devotees, by lay followers, this is the more significant meaning, since all of those precepts are modes of moral training. They all have a moral significance. Abstaining from the taking of life, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, those certainly have directly a moral significance. And then the precept of abstaining from the use of intoxicants is included because the use of intoxicants, when one uses intoxicants, then it dulls the sense of conscience, the sense of restraint, and so a person will then be readily disposed to act in ways which transgress the other precepts. But the word sila also has another level of meaning in the Buddha's training. It takes on the sense of a training in restraint, a restraint of bodily action, of verbal action, which is not necessarily moral in the sense in which we usually understand the word, but a restraint which is intended to curb the outward expression of the defilements in bodily and verbal actions. And the defilements don't necessarily express themselves in ways that are immoral or transgressions of the standards of morality, but they express themselves in ways which we can call self-indulgence. And self-indulgence is an expression of usually of craving. Sometimes the defilements will express themselves in forms which are manifestations of anger, spitefulness, envy, other minor defilements, the secondary defilements. And so the Buddha has laid down, especially for the monastics, numerous training rules which are intended to restrain these outer expressions of the defilements in bodily action and in verbal action. And so all of these training rules, which range from those which are of great weight, great significance, to those which seem to be of relatively minor significance, make up this training in sila, which here translates somewhat inadequately as virtue. And in this paragraph, the Buddha refers to, he uses the word patimokkha. The word patimokkha is the specific code of monastic rules that he has laid down for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. In the Theravada version, which has come down in the Theravada tradition, for the bhikkhus it consists of 227 rules. Of these, several are of extremes, of extremely weighty, of such great weight that if a monk transgresses against them, he's expelled from the order. Others range in weight from those which require formal meetings of the Sangha to those which can be exonerated simply through confession to another monk. But this code of monastic rules is intended to establish the foundation in the ethical training, the disciplinary training, the training in sila for the monastics. And here the Buddha introduces this passage in order to show that this training in sila is the foundation for all the higher stages of the practice and for all of the benefits which are going to follow through the fulfillment of the training. And that those will be enumerated in the course of the discourse. According to my friend Venerable Analio here, he's doing comparisons of the suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya with their counterparts in the Chinese translation of the Madhyama Agama, that is taken from the Sarvastivada version. This passage on the 12 possessed of virtue is not included in the Chinese translation, Chinese version. But the sutta begins directly with the passage, if a bhikkhu should wish. And so it could be the case that either this version was added to the Pali, or else that this version was omitted. We can't even infer that it was not present in the original Sanskrit that had come into China. It could have been in the Sanskrit version and then omitted in China. But we find the same passage elsewhere in the Pali suttas, and presumably they'll be also in the Sarvastivada counterparts of other Majjhima Nikaya suttas. So it seems to me quite consistent with the Buddha's teaching that it would have a fitting place in the structure of the path, whether or not it was originally part of this discourse. Okay, but now we come to a fuller statement of the requirements. Now we come to the Buddha's going to make a statement of the benefits that are going to come as a result of fulfilling the training. And so the Buddha will begin by enumerating different benefits and then show the training that is to be fulfilled in order to receive those benefits. And he'll begin at a fairly mundane level, worldly level, and then lead, which is his typical pattern, leading step by step to higher and higher achievements until he brings the discourse to its climax with the achievement of the final goal of the spiritual life. Okay, so he begins with the statement, if a bhikkhu, a monk, should wish, may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the spiritual life, respected and esteemed by them, then here comes the refrain, that is the passage that's repeated again and again. Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind. Here it's rendered not neglect meditation, but I'll come back to this. Be possessed of insight and dwell in empty huts. Okay, first we'll take the refrain, explain these terms. Okay, first, if the monk wishes to obtain this particular object of aspiration, this particular achievement, then he should fulfill the precepts. Okay, now, in the Buddha's teaching, the stages of the path are divided into these three main phases of virtue or moral discipline, samadhi, concentration, and panya, or wisdom. And the end of these three stages is liberation, vimukti. Now in this passage, okay, we have the terms, let the monk fulfill the precepts. The Pali is silesu eva asa paripurakari. Here the word translated precepts is just the plural of the word rendered virtue, sila. In Pali, the word sila can, if it's used singular as a singular, it will take on the meaning of virtue or moral discipline, ethical discipline. If it's used as a plural, it takes on the meaning of the means to moral, the branches of moral discipline, the aspects of virtue, the different modes by which one achieves virtue, which are the precepts. And so virtue is covered by observing the precepts. Then let him be devoted to internal serenity of mind. This is ajjatang cheto samatang anuyuto. So you must have come across the word samatha as one of the aspects or facets of Buddhist meditation. That is the word used here, but it's used in the compound cheto samatha. That is indicating that it's the quieting, the calming down, the tranquilizing of the mind. But there's another word to reinforce the idea that one should be devoted to the practice of concentration or samadhi, another expression. This is anirakata jhano. Here it was translated, let him not neglect meditation. But the key word in the Pali is jhana. And I think it might have been better to have translated it, or to have retained the Pali word, let him not neglect jhana, or even the jhanas. Or we can say, since here the emphasis is on making an effort, maybe, so let him not neglect the meditation aimed at the jhanas. And then the next phrase is, let him be possessed of insight. This is vipassanaya samanagato. Here we have the word vipassana. But here vipassana, it doesn't mean let him practice a particular system, method of meditation, undertake certain courses, but it's let him acquire a particular quality that comes as a result of undertaking particular or giving particular slant to the practice of meditation. Well, let him develop meditation in a particular way such that it leads to the arising of insight, the achievement of, call us this deep penetrative observation or contemplative insight into the nature of things. And then the last phrase in the refrain is, let him dwell in empty huts, bruheta sunya gharam. Here, with this phrase, the Buddha is indicating the appropriate place for developing serenity and insight. That is, the Buddha often mentions many places to which one can resort for meditation, the foot of a tree, the forest, sometimes an open field, but usually he ends at an empty house, an empty hut. So here, just to keep it short and simple, he says, let him dwell in empty huts. This would be even a empty room, quiet room someplace, we could say will count as an empty hut. Okay, so these are the conditions that the Buddha is prescribing as the basis for the fulfillment of one's wishes. You know, children on Christmas, when they go to sleep, on Christmas Eve, they're supposed to make wishes that Santa Claus will come and fill their stock, they hang up the stocking by the chimney. Is that correct? Do they do that? Yeah. And then they make a wish, and then Santa Claus is supposed to come and fill the stocking with the things that they wish. Well, this is, the Buddha is now laying down or prescribing the conditions. If a monk wants to get his stocking filled by Santa Claus, then it's not a matter of just making wishes without fulfilling the conditions, but one has to establish certain conditions. And when these conditions are established, then all of these wishes will just naturally be fulfilled. And so one begins with, as I said earlier, the Buddha begins at a fairly mundane level with a natural wish that will come to somebody, maybe a fairly newly ordained monk, that he wants to be accepted by his fellows, his fellow monks. He wants to be accepted by them as friends. He wants to be found dear and agreeable to them. And more elder monks will want to be respected and esteemed by them, and also to be considered dear and agreeable to them. And so the basis for achieving this, for fulfilling these very simple and natural wishes is by fulfilling the precepts, being devoted to the practice of serenity of mind, not neglecting the meditation that leads to the jhanas, aiming to acquire insight and dwelling in empty huts. Okay, the next wish here, a monk might think, may I be one to obtain robes, alms food, a dwelling, a resting place, that's a dwelling place, and medicinal requisites. Let him fulfill the precepts. And this, maybe somebody raises the question, it seems like the Buddha is trying to, these four things that are mentioned here, these are called the four requisites or four supports of the monastic life. Because when one enters the monastic life, one gives up all of the usual excessive worldly possessions, but there are four indispensable supports that one needs to lead even a simple ascetic life. One is that one needs robes to cover the body, and when old robes get worn out, then one has to replace them with new robes. One needs, every day, one needs alms food or food. And in the time of the Buddha, the monks would generally go on alms round with their bowls. They would go to the village, to the town, and go from door to door collecting food. They would need a resting place, even if it's just a simple hut, we call it a kuti. And in time of sickness, they would need medicinal requisites. And these also include things that can be taken in the evening as refreshment. Okay, so the monks are dependent for these things upon the support of the lay community, and lay people want to support monks who they see are well-disciplined, virtuous, and devoted to the training, the spiritual training, the training of the mind, cultivating the higher consciousness, the higher mind through the development of samadhi, and developing the higher wisdom through the practice of insight. And so when monks become negligent and fail to engage in the practice, then lay people, and especially when they neglect their monastic discipline, their precepts, then lay people think, well, these monks are not very different from ourselves. Why should we support them? But when the monks observe the precepts and set example of people leading lives of restraint, discipline, cultivating the higher qualities of the mind, then people are inspired by this. They develop faith, confidence, trust, dedication to the Sangha, and then they want to support the monks. Even though this becomes a problem, if they want to give too much support, then the monks have to say, at a certain point, enough. But that support is needed in order to enable them to continue in their monastic life. And now somebody might think when the Buddha is mentioning this, it seems like he's trying to induce a monk to fulfill this training with promises of achieving the material requisites. But the commentary explains that one shouldn't think that the Buddha is using any kind of subterfuge or any kind of inappropriate means to bribe a monk with promises of material gain. But rather, he's just trying to allay the fears or anxieties of some monks who think that if they enter earnestly and seriously upon the training, that they won't be able to get adequate support. So he's assuring them that if you fulfill the training, the support will come. And this is very true. Okay, paragraph 5. Okay, this is, might call the reciprocal side of number 4. If a bhikkhu should wish, may the services of those whose robes, alms food, dwellings, and medicinal requisites I use bring them great fruit and great benefit, let him fulfill the precepts. Let him fulfill the precepts, etc., etc., be possessed of insight and dwell in empty huts. Okay, how are we to understand this paragraph? What is the meaning here of great fruit and benefit? Okay, this paragraph, what underlies this paragraph is the principle of karma and its fruit, or we call this in this particular case, okay, the general principle is the principle of karma and its fruit. The principle that when one does a particular type of volitional action, any kind of ethically significant willed action, intentional action, that action has the tendency, the potentiality to produce fruits or results that correspond to the moral quality, the ethical quality of that action. This is the law of karma, the general law of karma. So wholesome actions, actions springing from generosity, loving kindness, wisdom, will bring beneficial fruits, beneficial results, while unwholesome actions, actions springing from greed, anger, hatred, delusion, will bring unfortunate results, painful results, misery and suffering in the future. Okay, now wholesome actions, considered from the standpoint of their ability, their potentiality of producing beneficial results within the cycle of rebirths, of bringing good results, fortunate results from life to life, are called merit. We use the Pali word punya. So people generally wish to have to be, assuming one accepts the idea of rebirth, to be reborn under good circumstances, say in a safe country, to be reborn in a good realm of existence, in a safe country, to enjoy in the course of one's life a relative level of prosperity, freedom from deprivation, not to be, to live in, say, a war-torn country, a country afflicted with poverty and disease, to have a relatively long lifespan, to have good health, to be successful in one's undertakings. Okay, these benefits are the fruits, from the Buddha standpoint, they are the fruits of meritorious deeds. And in order to enjoy these fruits in future lives, and I think the most important fruit from the Buddha standpoint at a relative level is in one's future lives to come again and again into contact with the Buddha's teaching and to meet good teachers, good spiritual friends, kalyana mitras, and have the opportunity to practice under good conditions. Otherwise, if one gets reborn in a wealthy country, one enjoys a high standard of living, has good health, long lifespan, but one is just either blinded by materialism or following or dogmatic religion, then one doesn't reap the fruits of generating merit within the framework of the Buddha's dispensation, the Buddha's teaching. Okay, so one of the aims in following the Buddha's teaching, in order to secure good conditions for oneself in the future, is to generate merit, to acquire merit. And a field for Buddhism, the supreme field of merit for the world, is the Sangha, that's the community of ordained monks and nuns. And the monks and nuns subsist on very simple requisites. They don't, ideally, if they're true monastics, they don't need luxuries, they don't want luxuries, but they need these basic material supports. And so the lay community supports the monastics with these basic, simple, basic requisites. And by doing so, the lay people generate merit, which has the capacity to produce great fruit and benefit. And the merit comes because lay people, the people who are supporting the monastics, are giving them their requisites with a mind of trust, confidence, and faith, inspired by the example of these monastics, because they have faith and devotion to the Triple Gem, and because they want to support the Buddha's teaching by supporting the continuity of the monastic order. And the potency of the merit on one side is proportional to the purity of the intention of the donors, of those who are giving. But on the other side, it's also supported by the purity of the recipients. So when the recipients are leading virtuous, upright lives, when they are undertaking the training in virtue, concentration, and wisdom, then they are creating the conditions for their lay supporters to generate greater merit for themselves by making offerings to the Sangha, or offerings to them as individuals, by supporting them as individuals. Whereas if the monastics are leading slack lives, neglecting their duties, not undertaking the training, or even if they're transgressing the basic principles of the monastic life, then even though the lay people who give might do so with great faith and devotion, by reason of that faith and devotion, that will create, for the people who give, it will create great merit, but the merit will not be as potent as it will be if the recipients are leading pure and wholesome lives in accord, following the true standards of monastic training. So there comes this, you call it a confluence, a flowing together of two contributing factors to the potency of the merit. That is, the purity of the intention, the frame of mind, state of mind of the givers, the supporters, and the purity of conduct and the inner qualities of the recipients. And so the monastics will have the compassionate wish, if they're true monastics, that the lay people who support them will gain great benefit by giving support. And so that compassionate wish will serve as a kind of goad or prod that will nudge them, push them into fulfilling the training. So if they truly want their supporters to gain the benefits that come from generosity, that come from making offerings, from giving the requisites, then they should be upright in fulfilling the precepts, training in serenity and insight, and devoting themselves to dwelling in empty huts. Okay, paragraph 6. If a bhikkhu should wish, when my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died remember me with confidence in their minds, may that bring them great fruit and benefit. Let him fulfill the precepts, and so on and so on, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty huts. Okay, maybe this will be puzzling some of you. How can my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died remember me with confidence in their minds? Maybe there's a mistranslation here. Maybe it's the bhikkhu who should be remembering the kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died. But in fact, the translation is correct here. But it needs an explanation. Okay, what the text is referring to here? Okay, when people pass away and die, in some cases they may be reborn very soon, very quickly, into the human existence, into some other state of existence. But it may be the case that after people pass away and die, that the consciousness remains in a realm, a state, which is called the state of certain types of petas. Sometimes it's translated as ghosts. But that's a little bit misleading. We think of ghosts as being frightening beings that hide in the closets and come out on Halloween. But these are, maybe we call them spirits. I don't want to call them disembodied spirits because they have subtle bodies that we normally can't see. But they're beings in a kind of intermediate state. They are able to witness events taking place in the human realm. They can see us, though generally we cannot see them unless one has developed some superior power of sight, the divine eye. Though I'm told that dogs can bark at them, so the dogs seem to have a better sense of their presence than the humans do. Okay, now the beings in this state often, they're not able to create any merit on their own. And they're in a state of, it's not an intense suffering like the hell realms, but it's a kind of very dry, sterile state of almost like being stranded in a desert, crossing a desert, and needing some kind of sustenance to reach the end of the desert. And these beings they're able to tune in to their human relatives surviving in the human realm and to find out whether the human relatives are doing anything to help them. And if the surviving human relatives whether you know that they're in that realm or not, but if one does good deeds on their behalf and directs the mind to these deceased relatives, if they are in that realm, they are able to witness the good deeds being done on their behalf and rejoice in those good deeds. And by rejoicing, they gain that sustenance, that food and nourishment that helps them cross the desert of this very dry, barren, sterile spirit state that they're in, till they come to the end and then take rebirth back into the human realm, or maybe go on to a celestial realm. And so in Buddhist countries, it's a common practice for lay people to regularly make offerings. They call Sanghika Dana. They invite monks to their homes, or they go to the monastery. They make offerings, usually on the anniversary of the parents passing away. And then they they hold that dana, that meal offering, in memory of their parents. Then at the end, they direct the mind to their deceased parents and share the merit with them, wishing that their parents, if they're in this spirit realm, witness the good deeds done on their behalf, rejoice in it, rejoice in the merits, and be well and happy. And for monks, the monks are able to share the merits of their lives with their deceased relatives by radiating thoughts of loving kindness, compassion to them, and wishing that their deceased relatives be well and happy. And they can do so when they fulfill the training. Then they can direct the mind to the relatives, wishing that they be well and happy. Or even if they're not deliberately directing the mind to the relatives, but the relatives in the spirit realm will still witness their survivors who are now monastics, and if they see that these monks or nuns are really living the pure, upright, wholesome, spiritual life, then they will be happy, they will rejoice, they will have this trusting confidence in them, and then that will bring benefits to those spirit beings in this intermediate realm. And so that is why the Buddha gives this advice to the bhikkhus. He says, if you wish your relatives to get great fruit and benefit from remembering you with a confident mind, then you should fulfill all of these stages of the training. Okay, paragraph 7. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I become a conqueror of discontent and delight, and may discontent not conquer me, may I abide transcending, or better, overcoming discontent whenever it arises, let him fulfill the precepts. Okay, we have two terms here. Arati is discontent. Rati, it's more than content, but it's delight. So arati, absence of delight, but you can't say non-delight. Okay, what is meant? Okay, there's a positive kind of delight that the Buddha encourages, a positive rati, which will be delight in, you know, the higher stages of the meditation, delight in insight, delight in the higher attainments, delight in the spirit, in different aspects of this, of the spiritual life. But what is meant by delight here for a monk would be taking delight in the enjoyment of sensual pleasures, taking delight in worldly interests that pull one away from the higher training. Okay, now, arati, that's called discontent. It's not the grumbling, complaining type of mind, though it might include that, but it's a particular phenomena that arises to those living a monastic life, a life of renunciation, of restraint, in which one is drawn away, naturally drawn away, from the pleasures of, say, social engagement, sensual engagement, sexual gratification, the enjoyment of sense pleasures. At certain points, and this I think happens to many who lead monastic life, all of us have gone through it, I think, there come times, especially the experience like the newly ordained monk, full of enthusiasm, fervor, ardor. He goes out into this forest, into this empty cottage, empty hut. People bring him food. He says, no, I want to go on alms round. He goes to alms round to the villages. He comes back, wonderful, wonderful, magnificent. He's now meditating 27 hours a day and maybe enjoying, if he has like sankharas from the past, getting quickly into these blissful states, going now 6 months like this, wonderful, blissful, magnificent. Then, little by little, this starts to dry up. It's just like the pattern of the mind. You know, maybe he's able to dwell in these blissful states, really intense blissful states, 4 hours at a stretch. Now, like the bliss level of studies, it's been like all the way up at maybe on a scale of 1 to 10, it's always been up at 9.5 on the scale. Now, suddenly he's just putting in his, you know, 27 hours a day, maybe boosting it up to 29, 30 hours a day. But the bliss level, suddenly it's 7.5. What's happening? So maybe he boosts it up to, you know, 34 hours a day. But the bliss level, it's dropping down to, you know, quick 6.5 per day. 5, it's down there to 5. And then, okay, he's letting up. Still, now he's trying to use a little wisdom. Okay, I have to strike the middle path. So he's back taking it easy, trying to strike a more balanced approach. But still, that bliss level is dropping, until that kuti, that hut deep in the forest, begins to look like a dungeon. And what am I doing in this forest? Maybe he hears some, you know, the wind blows some music from the town, comes drifting. Music. There's a party going on there. Then the music comes, and then the memories of friends and enjoyment. Maybe a little tune that he heard when he was a teenager comes. That's bringing up memories. Then the next day, time to go on alms round. You know, it was early, there was so much enjoyment going on the alms round, but now he's thinking, people, why aren't they bringing the food to my cottage? I have to go on alms round. I have to go walking a mile, 2 miles, cross streams, these muddy streams, and it's the rainy season, the monsoon season. I'm going to be slipping on the creeks, and there are leeches along the path. And then the food, just the same rice and curries. When I was living in the household, I could just order whatever I wanted. Okay, so all of this starts to build up, and then all of the bright colors, everything starts to seem black and white and gray. And then that that feeling descends upon the mind, and that becomes discontent. That is the discontent. And then if one doesn't know how to handle that, then it brings the feeling that, well, maybe the monk's life, not for me. Maybe I don't have the right sankharas, the right mental dispositions for it. So that is the discontent. And so the way to conquer this discontent is to be one who fulfills this training, but fulfills it in a skillful, balanced way. And I think the text, though, it begins by saying, may I become a conqueror of discontent and delight. But then it continues and say, may discontent not conquer me. May I abide transcending or overcoming discontent whenever it arises. It doesn't mention discontent and delight, transcending discontent and delight. I wonder why that is the case. Maybe because this discontent, it's a more powerful obstacle. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. In the Chinese translation. It doesn't mention the delight. Mm-hmm, that's an interesting point. In any case, when one is fulfilling the training, then when one is fulfilling it skillfully, in a balanced way, then one will have, first one will have true joy from fulfilling the training in virtue, what the Buddha calls this unblemished happiness. Then, when one is fulfilling the training in serenity of mind, then one will have this piti sukha, this joy and happiness, particularly if it reaches close to or enters the level of jhana, then becomes a very powerful, solid joy and happiness. And when one develops, acquires insight, when one sees into the impermanence, the arising and passing away of phenomena, then it brings also the strong joy and bliss which dispel that discontent. And that joy and bliss also serve as an alternative to the delight of worldly indulgence, sensual indulgence. And so in that way, they protect the bhikkhu from, on the one hand, from being overcome by discontent, and on the other hand, since they feed the mind with a joy and happiness, he doesn't want to look at the sensual enjoyment anymore because it is far inferior to the bliss and joy of the, especially the bliss, the joy and bliss that come with the training, with the achievements in the sphere of samadhi and panya. Okay, we'll take one more paragraph. Paragraph 8. If a bhikkhu should wish, May I become a conqueror of fear and dread. And may fear and dread not conquer me. May I abide transcending or overcoming fear and dread whenever they arise. Okay, these are two terms almost synonymous, though the commentary says bhaya can be subjective fear or an objective danger, something frightful on the outside, whereas the word translated dread, bhairava, means something frightful, something externally frightful. So it has a purely objective meaning. That's what the commentary says. But it seems to me that the important factor here is the subjective factor of fear. And so fear arises, okay, because of some sense of insecurity. And so when one is dedicating oneself to this training in virtue, concentration, wisdom, along the Buddha's path to liberation, to nirvana, then even when there's a truly objective threat to one's well-being, of course fear will arise unless one has reached the level of arhat, or perhaps anagami, or certainly arhat, who has no more fear. But in a person still at the level of an ordinary person, but still training earnestly, fear can arise, but one can check the mind or check that fear within the mind by reminding oneself that first that one is firmly established in virtue, which is even if things happen to one's physical body, still, though the physical body may be harmed, but the virtue will provide a solid nucleus, a solid foundation that will carry over, even if the body is destroyed, that will carry over, that virtue will encompass the mind, encompasses the mind, or permeates the mind, and will provide a foundation or a platform that will protect one in the transition over to the next existence. And even in this life, that virtue will give one a sense of inward composure or self-confidence in the face of any external threats. And then if the mind is developed, strongly developed in concentration, then when one faces externally threatening situations, then one can just withdraw the mind from those externally threatening situations, draw the mind into it within itself, and the mind remains calm and composed despite the external threats. Like I've read stories about some of these Thai achans, Thai meditation masters who would wander in the forests of northeast Thailand, and sometimes they, in the case of some that I've read, they might be meditating in a cave, then maybe a tiger will come into the cave. And normally a person sitting in a cave, you see a tiger come in and well, you're just overcome by panic, by overwhelmed, you just faint on the spot. But when you see the tiger come in, when the meditation monk sees the tiger come in, what does he do? He just sits there, crosses the legs, and just draws the mind back into samadhi. And then when he comes out from samadhi, tiger's gone. But to assure himself that he hasn't imagined anything in the stories that I've read, he sees the tiger's tracks on the ground. So it's not like he was having a fantasy. And I've read several stories like this. Another one, a meditating monk He was sitting on the ground, sort of lightly meditating. Then a king cobra came. This is in Thailand. A king cobra is a giant cobra, very deadly snake, the deadliest snake, came and it slithered over his body. And he started to become afraid. He wasn't an arhat. So he started to become afraid. He thought, what am I to do? What am I to do? So he thought, let me just withdraw the mind. And so he just, again, he just focused the mind on his meditation object, drew the mind into samadhi, and the cobra just wound itself around him, remained wound around him for some time. Then the cobra, after a little while, just unwound and slithered away. But if one gets afraid, then the cobra will realize that this person is afraid of me, and the cobra will strike. And then if one has panya or wisdom, then one can see into the selfless, egoless nature of oneself. If it's a creature threatening one, some animal, or even a person threatening one, robbers, thieves, vicious people, one uses this insight into selflessness to dispel the idea that there is any kind of substantial entity which is threatening any kind of real substantial I, self, which is threatened, and then the fear and dread will vanish. Okay, maybe we should stop here for this evening. If any questions, then please. Any questions, any comments? Yes. Preta, yeah. Yeah, in Sanskrit it's preta, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, but one clarification. Yeah, when you have the word preta, and then it's translated hungry ghost, it suggests the idea of those who are it's being tormented by this extreme hunger and thirst. Whereas I think what's indicated here are beings who are not in this state of extreme torment, but just they're a certain intermediate realms, which I call barren and sterile. It's not realms of straw, of intense suffering, but just of kind of insipid realms where there's no satisfaction, no ability to find any sources of sustenance, of happiness. Yeah, though it's not necessarily the physical hunger. Yeah, take that as a metaphor. The hunger is a metaphor. Some of these concepts I thought would be rather unusual, for the idea of generating merit and also about the intermediate realm. No. Excuse me? Okay, if there's no questions, then. Okay, Suki, yeah. No need to laugh over asking a question. Yeah. Can they affect us? In what way do you have in mind? Yeah. I mean, can they help us? This is a good point. Actually, this is a very good point. I think if they are in the Peta realm, I don't think they could help. Now I'm speculating here, but if they are reborn in, we do this akasa ta, chavuma ta, deva naga, okay. Akasa ta, chavuma ta devas, the earth dwelling devas, if they should be reborn as earth dwelling devas, perhaps sky-dwelling devas. I'm not so sure about the sky-dwelling devas, but the earth-dwelling devas, I believe that they are able in subtle ways to, let us say, act upon the chain of events, the chain of conditionality, causation, in ways that will affect us. But it's not so much an answer to our prayers. If we do bad deeds and then we pray, help me, help me, help me, they can't do anything. But it's when we do meritorious deeds and share the, in fact, there are verses, yeah, in the suttas, and share the merits with them, if they should be, whether they be our relatives or not, if we share the merits with the earth-dwelling devas, earth, the devas connected to the earth, then those devas, under certain conditions, can help us. There are some verses to this effect in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when Vasakara and Sunida offer, you know, these are the ministers of King Ajatasattu, when they offer they come to the Buddha and offer alms to him. After the Buddha receives that alms offering, then he recites these verses. Do you remember that? But you remember that there are such verses? But I don't have the text with me, but he says, let the house dwell, the generous, virtuous house dweller share his merits with the devas. Having compassion on them, they in turn will have compassion on him. Exactly to what extent they can influence the chain of causation, the chain of events, that I don't know. I just have an intuitive sense that they can. Are you able to do that, Rob? Yeah. It said something stronger than that. That he... You have the Mahaparinibbana Sutta with you?
Yeah.
In an English translation? Well, I don't see a book.
I didn't search for Davis and it brought me so from wherever he may dwell. I don't know if that's who you're referring to.
Yeah, this is
actually, wait, let me put the light on.
Yeah, these are the verses, isn't it? Go down a little further. Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's what I was reading. That's kind of sort of his translation, so maybe use different words.
Oh, I see.
Or gracious to him, even as a mother towards her son.
Gracious to him. Gracious, but it's anukampa. If I remember, the Pali is anukampa, which means sympathetic or compassionate. Mm. So gracious doesn't... Excuse me? Oh, of course, yeah.
I'm trying to reconcile.
Yeah.
In future times, I'm not there. Even then, I'm not able.
Yeah.
And I say that in no way is a good comment. Yeah. How I had understood that was that I'm giving this space to the song that kind of a raggedy monster. No difference.
Yeah.
And then real explanation.
To reconcile, I would say that paragraph. Let's see. Oh. Okay, I would say that paragraph 5 here is referring to gifts made to individuals. And so gifts made to individuals, the merit will be proportional or will be relative to the purity of the individuals. Whereas according to that Dakineya Vibhanga Sutta, when the merit, when the gift is offered to the Sangha, and that is, in theory, it's supposed to be, one gives the gift with the intention of offering it to the, what's called the Sangha of the ten, is it the Chaturdisa Sangha, the four directions and the three periods of time, so that one is, this is the way it's interpreted in Sri Lanka, when one gives the gift, one thinks I'm giving this gift to the entire Sangha from the time of the Buddha, including Sariputta, Moggallana, Mahakasapa, Ananda, Anuruddha, all the ways up to the present and extending into the future. And no matter which countries throughout the earth, so it's given to all of them. And so one just chooses individual monks, just taking them as representatives of this Maha Sangha. Okay, then we'll have to stop now. Okay. Can we do the sharing of the merit? Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparam Etavata Cha Ammehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Deva Anumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cha Ammehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabba Sampati